Well, the smell of spring is in the air, and that makes a lot of us think about getting out to the ballpark. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Kathleen Dunn today. Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network. But how much do you know about the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League? In the 1940s and 50s, it was a prominent fixture in the Midwest. And today we are going to talk about the teams, the players, how they got started, and why it went away. Jim Nitz is a Milwaukee native who loves to do research and writing on the Milwaukee-based baseball topics, such as Happy Felsch, Ken Keltner, Borchardt Field, and the Chicks of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. He's a secondary business education teacher and ninth grade softball coach, married to Wendy, and his children, Jeff and Beth, are both ball players. He joins me here in the studio. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Judith.
And happy spring.
Same to you. It's getting so gorgeous.
It's starting to feel spring-like out there. And I have to say, I grew up playing softball in Chicago. So this, as we will hear with the history of this league, that means it's near and dear to my heart. And I still play softball all these years later. Well, Jim, let's talk about where we were kind of as a culture. Set the stage for us. As America entered World War II, how popular was baseball?
Well, baseball was very popular, and what the concern was is that with basically half of the men being overseas or in the military, and with over half of the minor leagues just closing up shop by 1942, 1943, Philip Wrigley out of Chicago, which was and still is a hotbed for fast pitch softball, he felt that there was a market for a women's league, professional league, which was certainly a pioneering venture. And in 1943, he rolled out the league in the cities of Rockford, South Bend, Kenosha, and Racine, all smaller, war industrial type towns, a lot of factory, a lot of blue collar workers. And he felt that those would be the towns that would be the most receptive to a professional league. And he was right.
Well, and let's back up just a little bit. Why did he care so much? What happened with baseball during the war?
Well, being the owner of the Cubs and owning Wrigley Field, he had a vested interest in keeping the society in general interested in baseball. And with the fact that so many of the men were gone, and there was a concern that baseball would shut down. I know FDR sent all the owners at that time a message saying, hey, keep baseball going no matter what. We need it for the entertainment. We need it for recreation for all of the war workers. And he just felt that the Women's League would supplement that greatly. And in the event that men's baseball did go away, we still had a professional league to go back to.
And so, as I said, as someone who grew up in Chicago, I can attest to the fact that softball was a very popular pastime for men and women and girls and boys when I was growing up. Do you think that this idea for the Women's Professional Baseball League would have come out of another place other than Chicago, or was it really, was it the right person in Wrigley in the right place and time?
I would say he was the right person in the right place and time. The league never branched out nationwide. I mean, it did end up going to Michigan, towns such as Muskegon and Battle Creek, went up to Minneapolis for a short time, here in Milwaukee just for the 1 year, down to Peoria. So he wanted to keep it going in the Midwest and never really pursued anything any further. And again, because it's such a softball hotbed, Milwaukee had some very strong fast pitch leagues, especially in West Allis. And quite a few of the players from the league came out of those West Allis leagues, not to mention an awful lot of All-American Girls League ball players out of the Chicago leagues.
So there were some modifications made to bridge the difference between women's softball and men's baseball. What did they change?
Okay, well, what they did is they changed the rules that you would have seen in Chicago or in Milwaukee at the time. They went from 10 fielders down to 9 fielders, stretched out the base paths a little bit to 68 feet from 60 feet, and they allowed leadoffs and stolen bases.
That was so that's all making factor. It more like baseball.
Exactly. And then as the league developed over the years, eventually they went to sidearm and then eventually to overhand. And as that happened, the ball went from a 12-inch ball all the way down to right around 9 inches. So as the years went on, it became more and more like baseball. As depicted in a movie, League of Their Own, that was overhand, even though the movie supposedly took place in 1943. That would be just one minor inaccuracy, I would say, in that it was actually fast-pitch softball in 1943 versus the overhand hardball that you see in the movie.
Just an aside, I actually grew up playing 16-inch
softball.
We
were just talking about that at open gym the other night.
They're like medicine ball.
Yeah.
I mean, and I have very small hands. It was almost like a bowling ball to me, but without the holes to hold on to.
And you don't use gloves, from what I understand?
You don't use gloves.
Okay.
And I actually think that, again, just a little aside, I think the 16-inch softball is an even more kind of leveling game because you really don't need any equipment other than a bat and this ginormous ball.
And you can't hit the ball very far.
Exactly, not that much space because it really doesn't travel that far.
Exactly, definitely conducive to a big city type diamond, and it certainly levels the field for the big power hitters. There's only so far you can hit a ball that size.
Exactly. So where were the very first women's teams fielded?
Okay, so in 1943, we had just the four original teams, the Rockford Peaches. They played down at Byer Stadium, and that field has just been renovated recently with some nice historical markers. Oh. The actual ticket booth from the 40s is still there. And then we had the Racine Belles, and they played at Horlick Field in the year 2000. The All-American Girls League Players Association had the reunion here, and they put up several very nice historical markers on the old stone walls at Horlick Field. Kenosha Comets, and then also the South Bend Blue Sox. So that was all in 43. Then in 1944, because things were going so well, Wrigley decided to move to the larger towns of Milwaukee and Minneapolis.
Hmm. And so, again, kind of putting ourselves into that cultural and historical time, many men had gone off to fight in World War II. Many women were stepping into these jobs that had been traditionally held by men, not just playing baseball, but working in factories and all kinds of, you know, it was a very big time of women kind of getting the space to step into these roles. That doesn't necessarily mean that the mentalities always are, you know, right alongside those steps forward. So I guess one of my questions is how did people first respond to the idea of women playing, you know, it's not like rugby or something, but it's, you know, it's a very physical sport.
Right. And the women would slide in the skirts. I mean, the skirts that you see in the movie, those are actually what the women wore in the league. So they were hurt a lot by sliding. There was, you know, collision plays at home plate and in the bases. They would really get into it and, you know, beanings and hit by pitches. So, they played it just as aggressively, just as hard as any men's baseball team would. And they were all managed by male managers, most of whom were former major leaguers. And so the coaching that the ladies received was basically major league level coaching. And yeah, even though they were wearing the makeup and they were wearing the dresses, you know, which would kind of hint towards, you know, a more subdued game or feminine game, that is not the case at all. It was hard fought, tough games, and no love lost between a lot of the teams.
We are talking with Jim Nitz. He is a Milwaukee native who loves to research and write about Milwaukee-based baseball topics. And today we are talking about the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Kathleen Dunn. She will be back tomorrow. Later in the show, we are going to be joined by Joyce Hill Westerman. She's a former baseball player of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League and ended her career on a very high note with a championship. And we will talk with her about her experiences. And you are welcome to join in as well. How much do you know about the Women's Professional Baseball League? Did you see the movie A League of One's Own, of their own? Did you know about it before that? Or did it pique your interest? We'd love to have you join in by calling 1-800-486-8655. That's 1-800-486-8655. Well, let's talk just a little more about those uniforms because they were, well, controversial because they weren't really suitable for professional athletes. They had to wear these skirts. I remember reading in a biography of Joyce Westerman that, you know, that was a little bit of a problem, especially for the catchers since they were squatting behind the plate. But also, as you said, sliding, really painful. And it's interesting because Amelia Bloomer had made great strides for women several decades earlier with the knee-length puffy pants that we call bloomers now, but Philip Wrigley didn't go for those.
No, he really stressed femininity, and that's where the charm school came in. So the scene from A League of Their Own with the charm school, that did occur during the first few years of the league. Some of the Milwaukee chicks that I interviewed just basically would laugh about it, and they say, yeah, it was something that we had to do. If you wanted to play in the league, you had to go to charm school. If you wanted to play in the league, you had to wear the skirt. There is a scene in A League of Their Own where that's really brought out very forcefully to the ladies, you know, if you can't wear our uniforms, you can't play in our league. So again, going to the 1940s, that's what our society more or less called for, and the women were happy to comply. They made a lot more money playing softball than they would if they were working in industry, like you say, mm-hmm. in a, you know, Rosie the Riveter type job.
Right.
So they were very happy to do that. A lot of these women had never really left their hometown, so now they were seeing the Midwest. There were tours later in the 40s to Cuba. There were exhibition games at Wrigley Wrigley Field, Yankee Stadium, Griffith Stadium in Washington, D.C. So the ladies experienced locations and events that they never would have seen otherwise. So they were happy to comply with it.
Well, and it is interesting because, you know, like we said, they were stepping into these roles, like the Rosie the Riveter kind of roles, but yet they had to go to charm school because there was a certain... They were women athletes, but they kind of first and foremost were ladies.
Exactly.
Or girls. I mean, it was called the Girls League.
Every reference in the newspaper, when I went through all the 1944 newspapers, obviously the articles were all written by male sports writers. Every reference, even though they were anywhere from about 18 to 25 years old, it was all girls. It was never women. It was always mm-hmm. girls. So, yeah, obviously there's a big cultural shift since then in terms of how we refer to women and how we treat them, and certainly in terms of the clothing and the makeup mm-hmm. and all that. They literally had to wear makeup during the games and had to touch it up between games of a doubleheader. Talk about a 90-degree day and having to handle that.
Well, and speaking of doubleheaders, they played incredibly grueling schedules.
And then ride on a very hot bus from Rockford to Kenosha to South Bend. In the case of Minneapolis, that was a very long bus ride in 1944. And then later years in the league, Springfield, Peoria, Muskegon, Battle Creek. And the buses were not air-conditioned back then.
Wow. And if I'm remembering correctly, they played single games 6 days a week and then a doubleheader on Sundays.
Correct.
So the only time they got a day off was in the case of a rainout.
Exactly. And then if it was a rainout, they'd have to make that game up as part of another doubleheader. So they really didn't win in terms of how many games they played, but yeah, they had to end up playing more doubleheaders. And they only had 16 to 17 women rosters, so it wasn't like the current 25-man right. roster you have in Major League Baseball or even a college fast pitch team or the professional league that's out of Chicago and Akron right. and some of those other towns right now.
Wow. It's just amazing to think. So I think about things like how long it's taken for soccer to really get a foothold in the U.S. and how, you know, it's really taken decades of kids coming up and learning it and loving it and then, you know, wanting to watch it as adults and have their kids play. It seems really incredible to me that so quickly after coming up with the idea of this women's league that Wrigley could make it so successful that after a year he was already expanding. I mean, where did these women come from and how were they ready to play at this level
okay.
of sport?
Well, they came from all over the United States, Canada, a few of the Milwaukee Chicks, in fact, were from Canada. Again, the Midwest, Arizona, California, a lot of players, the Milwaukee Chicks left fielder, their second baseman, they were all from California. So, and just like in the movie where John Lovitz is doing the scouting, they had scouts out. And in 1943, the tryouts were in Wrigley Field. In 1944, they were in Peru, Illinois, and if you made it, you were then allocated to a team. You were actually signed to a contract by the league, and then the league decided where to place you.
I think that's really interesting because it really made for a very competitive league because
exactly.
It wasn't who could pay the most, basically.
Right. Yeah, and they all, I mean, certainly the stars made a little bit more than the everyday type players. But yeah, Wrigley wanted to make sure there was parity, that it was a very competitive league. He didn't want people in South Bend going away because of the fact their team was weak. So, and even midseason, players would shift. And that's one thing that really helped the Milwaukee Chicks was they picked up a few players in June of 44, and they went on to be the champions.
So you said that most of the coaches were men and former professional baseball players. What was the training like?
Well, they would have the tryouts, and there was some teaching and training going on there. Then after the tryouts and the teams were selected and the players were allocated, then they would actually have a training camp. And Max Carey was one of the best base dealers in baseball history. He's in the Hall of Fame, and obviously the 44 Chicks, and then later on the Fort Wayne Daisies, who he managed. They all, yeah, great name.
Daisies, the Peaches, and the Chicks.
Yes. They all were very fast teams. It was a pitching and defense and base stealing league, and Max Carey was one of the better guys at coaching that. So to have a Hall of Famer being your manager, you can't go wrong.
We are talking with Jim Nitz. He's a Milwaukee native who loves to research and write about Milwaukee-based baseball topics. You can tell that from his enthusiasm, which is really quite contagious. We are talking about the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League, and we will be joined a little later in the hour by Joyce Hill Westerman. She is a former baseball player with the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League and has been the subject of a couple biographies and is a fascinating person. We're really looking forward to having her join us. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn, who will be back tomorrow on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, we are talking with Jim Nitz about the history of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. He's a researcher and writer and has written quite a bit about the topic. He'll also be doing an event at the Wisconsin Historical Society Museum later in the week on that topic. And later in the hour, we are going to be joined by Joyce Hill Westerman, who is a former player in the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn. You can join in at 1-800-486-8655. That's 800-486-8655. And actually, let's go to the phones and Ed in West Allis. Hi, Ed.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
So, where did the Milwaukee Chicks play? Who was the best player in the league consensus? The champions, what did they get? Did they get a ring or a trophy or Wrigley Spearmint gum for life? Or... Then you mentioned Happy Felsch, and I'd just like to know, when he left the White Sox, I think he came back to Milwaukee and was a tavern owner, and I'd like to know where his tavern was. So those are my questions.
All right, and I think I got them all down. So first off, where did the Milwaukee Chicks play, Jim?
Okay, the Milwaukee Chicks played at Borchardt Field, which was the longtime home of the American Association Milwaukee Brewers, an old wooden ballpark that was located between 7th and 8th Streets, between Burleigh and Chambers. Right now, if you want to go to that site, you actually have to be on I-43 and you're going underneath the Burleigh Bridge, so you can't actually walk on that, what we consider holy ground, when you figure of all the great Hall of Famers and the great teams that played there. But the Chicks played there in their 1 year. They played games typically more in the afternoon, and then the Brewers had the evening games. They were the landlords, and they had the pick of the better times.
And so actually, that brings up a point that I wanted to make sure we touched on. The idea was that Philip Wrigley was afraid that men's baseball would suffer so much with the war effort that baseball as the national pastime would kind of disappear. But men were still playing in this period.
Correct. Right. Now, the American Association at that time was the highest level minor league, as well as several other ones. I think the Pacific Coast League and the International League, if I'm not mistaken. But a lot of the lower level leagues, the B, C, D type leagues, those are the ones that disappeared because of the war effort.
So it was more worry maybe about the feeder
exactly.
leagues.
Exactly. Exactly. So, yes, they played at the same stadium. In fact, it was interesting. In 1944, we had three Hall of Famers at Borchardt Field. On any given day, you could see Bill Veeck. You could see Casey Stengel. Bill Veeck was the Brewers' owner. Casey Stengel was the Brewers' manager. That was his one and only year in Milwaukee before he moved on to bigger and better things. And then, of course, Max Carey, the Hall of Famer who was managing the Chicks. In terms of what they received for being the champs, I've never read
that.
That's
an interesting question.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I've read a lot of material on the All-American Girls League. Yes, they did receive a nice trophy, which proceeded to go to Grand Rapids with the team because that's where the Chicks ended up moving to. If they received the bonus, there was nothing that I've ever seen written about it, but there may have been a small bonus involved.
Well, and we can also ask Joyce Westerman because she ended her career as a champ. So we will ask her what she got, if it was just Wrigley's gum or not. And also, Ed wanted to know if there's consensus on who the best player in the league during those, 11, 12 seasons was.
Yeah, well, Dottie Kamenschek was probably considered the best everyday ball player. In fact, she was considered so good that several baseball owners said if she were male, they would sign her right away. Connie Wisniewski, the Iron Woman, she was the Chicks' number one pitcher. She won all four of the Chicks' victories in the seven-game 1944 playoff series. She was incredible. When the league went to overhand, she was not an overhand pitcher, so she ended up being an outfielder, and she ended up leading the league in home runs 1 year. So she could hit as well as pitch, just depended upon the style of ball, and she was able to adapt.
And I think the final question was, where was Happy Felsch's tavern?
Okay, he had several taverns. One was on Tetonia, and I don't have that information on me. I haven't looked at that recently, but it was on Tetonia, and I think just north of Center, and then he had another one on about 24th and Center. And yes, he did come back to Milwaukee. He did some barnstorming in the 20s, but then remained in Milwaukee for the rest of his life. He also ended up doing some factory work, some crane operating work, and died, I believe, in 1964, if my memory serves me correctly.
Thanks for that call, Ed. And you can join in at 1-800-486-8655. Well, Philip Wrigley was certainly someone who understood marketing, having a very successful business, chewing gum and other things. How did he go about branding the All-American Girls professional baseball league and getting people in the seats?
Well, in the four smaller towns, he worked very hard to get local business people to buy into the team, literally to put up sponsorship money. They also placed a great emphasis on the fact that this is your community's team. Support the Peaches, support the Comets, support the Bells. And by coming to the games, you're, you know, part of our larger overall community. That was one of the reasons why the league didn't fly real well in Minneapolis and Milwaukee. Much larger towns, many other things to do.
A lot of competition.
Exactly.
For attention and money.
Oh, yeah. I mean, here we had State Fair. Here we had the Brewers. And then the other issue was he didn't ask for local ownership in Milwaukee and Minneapolis. So,
whereas in the smaller markets it was.
Exactly. So a lot of local buy-in, and radio stations would broadcast the games in the smaller towns. That did not occur here in Milwaukee, so he was missing that part of the marketing mix too.
But it seems like he really had a good formula for those smaller markets.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in the smaller towns it was wildly successful, and then in 1945, the Minneapolis Millerettes became the Fort Wayne Daisies, and the Milwaukee Chicks became the Grand Rapids Chicks, and those franchises were very successful. Same formula in the smaller towns, the mid-sized industrial war towns.
Let's go back to the phones, and we have listener Joyce in Mount Horeb. Hi, Joyce.
Hi.
Hi.
I am in Mount Horeb now, but I grew up in Grand Rapids.
Ah.
And I remember going to the Chicks games with my dad at least once a week. He loved to watch them play, and so did I. And the irony was that at that time, there were no classes or teams or anything for kids, you know, girls to play in. I remember wanting to be a pitcher so badly, but I could play sandlot baseball with the neighborhood, but there was no training, and you know, I was very frustrated with that, and I remember some of the players very well. But my dad also took me to the Detroit Tigers when they were playing. But I don't remember the exact years. I just know it was several years that we had the Grand Rapids Chicks.
Thanks for that call. Jim?
Great story. The Chicks did stay in Grand Rapids all of the way till the end of the league, which was 1954. Some of the towns like Racine, they did have a junior Bells program, so apparently they didn't in Grand Rapids. But that was an opportunity for the younger girls to more or less be mentored, be coached by the players that were on the actual team. Unfortunately, it didn't happen for this lady in Grand Rapids, but I have read articles about Junior Daisies, Junior Bells, Junior Comets, which is kind of neat to see that they actually did get into the community and try to grow the sport.
Well, and speaking of the Racine Bells, actually Chris in Burlington has a story that goes along with that. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. My question was just if he or any of you had any information on the Racine Bells, just more information. My aunt played for them way back when, and I was just curious.
Who's your aunt, Chris?
Her name was Toots.
Okay.
And her name was Ann Harnett.
Oh, yeah. She's one of the more famous players in the league. She may have been one of the original players in the league in 1943. There are numerous books that have been written about the league, and I'm not sure about one in particular about Racine, but all of the books make great mention of the Bells being one of the original teams. So I would definitely recommend, you know, just going online and finding some books that interest you, going to your public library. The All-American Girls League Players Association has a tremendous website with a lot of research resources. They have a very large bibliography that you can use to find various articles. Just go back and look at the newspapers, the Racine Journal Times, read through that. That would be a lot of fun to see what all happened at Horlick Field back in those days.
Chris, did you get a chance?
Did you
get a chance to learn about it from your aunt?
You know, I didn't. She passed away. It was my mother's aunt. She passed away, but I hear all the stories from my mother. She was also a nun.
Before, so during, or after stories. Playing baseball?
Say it once more.
Before, during, or after playing baseball, was she a nun?
After.
Oh, well, that's quite a second career. That's an interesting combination. Well, thank you so much, and I hope you can find some information on that, Chris. It would be amazing to have that kind of a family history connection.
Oh, that is just wonderful. Yeah, and just to, you know, wish you could have heard some of the stories that maybe she could have told. And I don't recall how long she played in the league, but she was a prominent member of the league. And again, there are so many resources. Ever since The League of Their Own came out, there has been so many books written, so many articles, websites. Cooperstown, the Hall of Fame itself, has a wonderful display. And then the Northern Indiana Center for History, they are the repository for everything from the All-American Girls League down in South Bend. So she may want to take a trip down there sometime and check out what they have.
Well, thanks for that call, Chris. And now I'm very pleased to be able to bring into the conversation Joyce Hill Westerman. She's a former baseball player for the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League, and she has been the subject of some biographies, including one written for young readers called Joyce Hill Westerman, Baseball Hero, that was published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. And Joyce, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you.
I'm so glad that you could join us today. What a fascinating piece of history that you were part of. How did you first start playing baseball, Joyce?
Well, I was very young, about 5 years old, and I lived next to my dad's brother, and he was a ball player. And he used to come out at that time and just throw some underhand balls and stuff to me. And I don't know, I just caught the bug and I just love playing with them. And I just went on. And actually, baseball has been almost my whole life. So it was just a lucky break that he lived there and, you know, that I got the opportunity to do that. Because in Kenosha, where I was born and raised, like most other places, there wasn't hardly any softball or anything for girls, nothing in the schools. So there was very few teams, so I had very few opportunities to play on a team. And actually I got most of my experience after I joined the league, so I had the ability and stuff, but you know, not the experience.
Well, I was actually surprised to read, Joyce, that I think it was in 1938, you started playing on your aunt's softball team. And just the fact that your aunt was on a softball team in 1938 kind of surprised me. You were only 12 years old, but you were as good as the adult women on the team. Did you ever dream at that point that it could lead to an actual career in baseball?
No, I never did. My big dream was always to be a professional baseball player, but that was just a dream. And I did play off and on, and I caught for my cousin, who was a pitcher on that team. And of course, it was a thrill, but I didn't play all that much, you know.
And then in 19... Oh, go ahead, Joyce.
But I, for my age and everything, I was pretty good.
Well, in 1945, you went down to Chicago to try out for the Women's Professional League. That was a really big trip for you. You had not been out of Wisconsin before.
That's right. So I had to catch a train and go down there, and I was scared to death, to tell you the truth. We didn't travel like these kids do today. They're world travelers, you know. But anyway, they met me at the station in Chicago and took me to the hotel, and everything worked out, and I made the league, and my first year I was sent to Grand Rapids, Michigan.
And tell us a little more about the tryouts. What was it like being there? What did you have to do to prove yourself?
Well, the whole league tried out as a whole, as a league, and we had to do exercises and run and throw, and we did everything that the men did, you know, on the field. And by the time the day ended, you know, you could almost crawl back to the hotel. They really put you through a lot of work.
And then how long was it before they told you that you had actually been drafted, that you had made the cut?
I can't remember exactly if it was a week we were there or whatever, but they finally told us, you know, that we would make the league, and so that was a big, exciting event for me.
We are talking with Joyce Hill Westerman. She was a player in the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. And we are also talking with Jim Nitz. He's a Milwaukee native who loves to do research and writing about Milwaukee-based baseball topics. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn. She will be back tomorrow. You can join in at 1-800-486-8655. That's 800-486-8655. And we have a caller on the line, Carol from Oak Creek. So let's go there. Hi, Carol.
Hi, thank you. Joyce, it's a great honor to speak with you. You're a pioneer. You've moved women's sports forward for younger women coming after you, not to mention keeping baseball alive. I would like to ask you, the previous guest, I don't know if he's still there, Jim, had said that the women on the baseball teams were happy to wear these skirts, these very short skirts. But don't you think that reflects a high degree of sexism for you women who had to wear these skirts, which resulted in more injuries than the men, you know, just so the women could show off their legs to the sexist attitudes of men?
Yeah, let's let Joyce respond to that. Hi, Joyce.
Hi.
So tell us about those skirts.
Well, they were like a dress, and it's not true that everybody liked them, because I didn't like them, and a lot of the other girls didn't like them. And the skirts were flared, and they'd get in the way, especially for pitchers when they were underhand pitchers. So they would pin them back or sew them back so that when you came through with your arm that they didn't hit the skirt and it would throw your pitch off. But anyway, they were very hot, and they weren't very, very safe. I mean, when we slid, we had a lot of bruises and bloody legs and stuff like that. And I wasn't very fast and much. I was a catcher, so I didn't steal a lot, but I still got my share of bumps and bruises on my thighs, you know. And but, you know, when they designed those things, I think that's what part of it was for, was, you know, to get the interest of the people, and especially the guys, to make you very feminine. That was the idea of it. And that's why, to begin with, they sent us to that charm school and wanted you to wear makeup and stuff like that. Well, it's not too practical, because if you got eyeshadow on and all this stuff, which I didn't have to do, actually, because I didn't start till 1945. Mm-hmm. But you put a mask on and this chest protector and your dress on and all that stuff, and you would perspire, and that stuff would run down your face, and it just, that wasn't practical at all.
Well, actually, so, Jim Nitz is still with us, and Jim, do you want to add anything on that?
Yes, I'm sorry, Carol, I didn't mean to say that the women enjoyed wearing the skirts. No, that was not it at all. They were all happy to be in the league, and if that meant that they had to wear the skirts, then that's what they needed to do. And the same thing with the makeup. But yeah, every single ball player I've ever spoken with, certainly including Joyce, yeah, you all would have much rather been wearing long pants and something that would have protected your legs also in the cold weather and, you know, in the early part of the season. So yes, I'm sorry if I misled you that way, but no, it was basically in order to play in the league. That's the only reason why they were happy to wear the dresses.
We are talking with Jim Nitz, who is a historian and researcher who does a lot of work on baseball topics, especially Milwaukee baseball topics. And we are also joined by Joyce Hill Westerman, who played in the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow at this time, Kathleen is back, and at this time she will be talking with Robert Habish. Milwaukee Magazine editor Kurt Chandler has written a new biography about Habish, a prominent and esteemed trial lawyer here in Milwaukee. Habish has won numerous awards and obtained big pretrial settlements involving Chrysler's rearview mirror design, flammable children's pajamas, unguarded front end loaders, and more. That's coming up at this time tomorrow. Right now, we are talking with Jim Nitz. He is a baseball historian and Milwaukee native, and we are also talking with Joyce Hill Westerman, who played in the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. And Joyce, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, we just touched on the charm school topic and the uniforms, but the women in the league also had to travel with a chaperone. What was that woman's job?
Well, Well, actually, it was her job to take care of us. Like if we got hurt or anything, she had to doctor us up. And if we had to go to the doctor, she would take care of that. And and another thing was to keep us in line because we had curfews and things like that, and she was supposed to check on the girls. I mean, she was like a mother away from home, actually.
And so were those women, you played for several different teams, so I'm assuming that you had several different chaperones. Were
right.
those women pretty important parts of your life as a young woman who you were living away from home for the first time, things like that? Did she play a pretty important role?
Yes, she was, because we could go to her if we had troubles or didn't feel well or anything like that, and she would take care of it for us and talk to us and get us whatever kind of help we needed.
You kept playing baseball, Joyce, after you married Ray Westerman, and he supported that, partly because it allowed you to save the money to build your own house. But, you know, it was also, I would guess, kind of unusual that a husband would support his wife traveling on the road, being away from home for long stretches. Was it unusual for a married lady like yourself to play baseball?
Well, actually, there weren't too many married women in the league. And like I said, I had played 6 years before I got married, and then I played 2 years afterwards. So there were a few married women, and some, there was a couple that had children and then came back to play, too. But for the most part, they were single girls, you know, and but it worked out fine. And what money I made, you know, I could save and send it home, and we did build our own house, my husband and I, and we had a really nice house, so it was very fruitful for me, too.
What I read, Joyce, was that it was very important to you to have your own house because your family had lost their house in the Depression when I think you were 5 years old, is that right?
Yes, that's right. It was, we went through the Depression, and my father was worked at Nash Motors, and of course, they laid way back until later in the war that they got to making airplane engines and stuff. And actually, I worked there a year before I started to play ball on airplane engines. And what was interesting, too, was that at that time, my dad was making $1 an hour. And when I signed my contract to play ball, I was making $50 a week, so I was making more than my dad made. And when we traveled, all our expenses were paid. So it was a good deal.
Jim Nitz, you have written about the league as a whole. One of the challenges, it seems, is that the women would play their season, but then, you know, then there's the rest of the year. Do you have a sense of what kind of jobs the women were able to find on the off season?
Well, I'm sure Joyce can confirm this, but during the off season, a lot of the women, Joyce, correct, stayed in the towns that they were playing in. In other words, if you played with the Comets, you stayed in Kenosha. I mean, I know you were a native there, but would find jobs, whether it was in industry. A lot of the ladies in the league were teachers. We had professors. As you mentioned, we have at least several nuns, but I think that was most Pulse League. So, Joyce, please share what you know about that.
Joyce,
the question again?
What were the other women doing for jobs on the off season?
Oh, well, for my own self, I could work on the farm. I lived on a farm, and my uncle would pay me a little bit. But for the most part, I got a job like at Simmons, and I even worked in a cabbage factory one time, trimming rotten cabbage. So I would do anything just to make a few dollars so I had money extra for Christmas and stuff like that. So I worked at Cooper's, and I worked at Simmons, and I worked at a lot of different factories. They would hire you just for part-time for the summer. So, and the other girls did the same. So, but most, I should say, I think most of our girls all went to college. So in the winter, they would go to college and then just try to get a part-time job besides going to school, because we had a lot of teachers in the league. So
Well, that's
I always manage to find something.
Well, let's go back to the phones, and Carl in Madison is up next. Hi, Carl.
Hi, Judith. In your introduction to the program, you mentioned Ken Keltner, and Ken Keltner lived across the alley from me, one house adjacent to the house behind us, and all of the kids in the neighborhood knew he was Ken Keltner, and he had something to do with baseball, but he was... He has a reputation of being a grouch and being a spooky kind of guy. So I was wondering if Ken could tell me a little bit more about him.
Sure, Jim.
Okay, well, Ken Keltner is the man who is known to have stopped Joe DiMaggio's 56-game hitting streak. He's from Bayview, which is on the southeast side of Milwaukee. I did my research and writing on him, you know, long after he died, so I really haven't heard a whole lot about his personality. But, you know, in a way, you know, like the Milwaukee Chicks, they were a part of the community, and, you know, I'm sure Joyce the same thing. She was a part of the community in the towns that she played in, and I know that the expectations were pretty high of the ladies from the All-American Girls League to be polite and cordial and not be a grouch. So I'm sure Joyce was very well received in the towns that she was playing in. And, you know, again, why Keltner was that way, I'm really not so sure. But
thanks for that call, though, Carl. And Joyce, how did you interact with the fans? Were you able to talk with them before or after the games? Or what about in the towns where you were living? Were you recognized on the street or, say, you know, in a diner?
Oh, yes, once in a while, as far as being in my hometown. But for the most part, the fans were great. And we had all kinds of fans we would talk to after the game. And the kids were just great. They would come up and want autographs and stuff like that. So we really enjoyed that. And to tell you the truth, we still go out to many places and sign autographs sometimes for an hour and a half or so. Like at the Brewers ballpark, we've signed autographs, and all kinds of places that they invite us to. So it's just, you know, it was always just very pleasant and a lot of fun.
In Madison, where I'm based, I'm happy to be here in the Milwaukee studios today. But in Madison, we have a very, and actually in Milwaukee too, but I just know the Madison League better. There's a very robust women's roller derby league. And one of the things I really enjoy about going to roller derby is seeing the kids and how excited little boys and girls, and not so little boys and girls, get cheering for really high quality women athletes. And I really feel like, you know, players like you and leagues like the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League really paved the way for a lot of that, Joyce.
Uh-huh, yes. It was great. I think that's one of the very important things that we did, was that we got the kids interested and the families interested in women's sports, because when we grew up, there just wasn't that same feeling. It was the feeling that, well, women shouldn't play sports because it isn't good for them and all this kind of stuff. So it was one way to prove that it didn't hurt any of us. We got married, had children, just like anybody else. So we've come a long way.
I'm sitting here with one of your autographed baseball cards in front of me that Jim Nitz brought in. And I have to say, looking at you, you're poised, having just caught a ball. You look like a real professional athlete to me, whether people thought that women were up to that or not.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you for that.
Joyce,
yeah, I enjoy the baseball cards. We people ask us for them, and once they knew that we played ball and were associated with a league of their own, why, they always ask for more baseball cards, you know. So we enjoy giving them out when we can.
So actually, in 1988, you mentioned this, the Baseball Hall of Fame honored you and other women's league members with a special exhibit. And then, of course, in 1992, the movie A League of Their Own came out. When you were playing in the league, did you ever dream that the league would get that kind of attention? And that many years later, I mean, we're talking 30, 40 years later.
Yes. No way in this world. Actually, I have a lot of memorabilia, and when I came home from the league, I put it in a cupboard, and there it sat for all those years. And nobody, even in Kenosha, really, at that time, then by that time, knew that I played ball. I played a lot of city league and county league after that. I even played with my daughters till they were in college. So nobody knew anything about it until then. In 1982, we had our first reunion. And there was, I don't know, I can't remember, but I thought there was about 150 ball players there. But that was one of the biggest thrills in my life also, when I got that letter, and it had a picture of the All-American girls on the envelope, and it was like somebody was writing to me for spring training, you know? And then to find out we were going to have a reunion, oh my. So I haven't missed but maybe one or two reunions in all these years. At first, we had them every 2 years, and now we have them every year.
Wow.
So I look forward to it every year just to see the girls. And, of course, they're getting fewer and fewer numbers all the time. Sure. We're losing so many. So this year at the reunion, I think there was only about 40-some girls at the reunion. And a year or so ago, like, it was 75, and, mm-hmm. you know, and yeah. a lot of them are ill, and a lot of them can't travel anymore, so that makes a difference. But we lose several every year, you know?
Mm-hmm, of course. Yeah, so. just like the World War II soldiers. Jim, do you have an idea of why all of a sudden, well, not all of a sudden, but in 1988, the Baseball Hall of Fame honored the league and then the movie? What was kind of what brought it back up to the surface?
Well, I know there was a documentary written by the he wrote the script, but then there was a documentary written by Kelly Kandel, whose brother played Major League Baseball. Their mom played in the league. Mm. And from what I understand, and Joyce, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe Penny Marshall caught wind of this and then decided to make the movie. And as we all know, she had quite a great cast there with right. the superstars such as Gina Davis mm-hmm. and Madonna mm-hmm. and Rosie O'Donnell and Tom Hanks. And that's where it really took off. But the Hall of Fame was ahead of the movie by 4 years and recognized the ladies long after mm-hmm. they should have been recognized. And then ever since then, as Joy said, it's really snowballed in the best possible way.
Better late than never, right?
Yes.
We have one more caller that I want to make sure we get to. So let's go to Karen in Shorewood. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
Hi.
What a great program.
Oh, thank you.
I think the person who got this going, I would call about something else, but Dottie Collins is, I think, the person who got this going with the Hall of Fame, because she started in, 1987. She tried to get the players from the All-American League together, and I think the Hall of Fame heard about it, and that started the ball rolling. But anyway, Marjorie Peters is what I had called about, and she lived in Greenfield, Wisconsin, and I met her, and she was very gracious. She played for the Rockford Peaches, and she sent me an autographed picture, you know, of her team from 1944. Another thing, I met Kenny Keltner, and he was very modest. He never said anything about, you know, stopping Joe DiMaggio's streak. Other people told me he was very modest about that. But anyway, it was really great. Marjorie Peters, I recognized her because she had a distinctive license plate, and I asked her about it. And this was before the movie started, and she was telling me all about it. Very, very nice lady. I don't imagine she's with us anymore.
Well, thank you for that call, Karen. Joyce, Marjorie Peters, has she passed away at this point?
I can't tell you that. I recognize the name, but I don't know. We have a whole list of people who passed away, but, you know, there's like over 600 girls that played in the league at right. one time or another. I know a lot of them having played for four teams. But you just don't know everybody, so I can't remember, you know, if she's passed away or not. I would have to look it up. And if we don't have a new directory, you know, she might have passed away this year or last year, and it still wouldn't be in there.
Well, Joyce, I want to thank you so much for spending the time with us today. It was a real honor and a real treat for me to get to talk with you.
Well, thank you very much. It was fun. I haven't done anything like this on the telephone before.
Well, you did great. Joyce Hill Westerman played in the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. We didn't even get a chance to talk about the fact that she ended on a very high note. She led the South Bend Blue Sox to a league championship in 1952 and also had her highest batting average that year. And Jim Nitz was in the studio with us, Milwaukee native who loves to do research and writing on Milwaukee-based baseball topics, including the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. Jim, what a pleasure.
Thank you very much for having me, Judith, and thanks for having Joyce.
It was a fun hour. Oh, well, and thank you for helping us connect with Joyce, because that was certainly a wonderful and interesting voice to have. Jim is actually hosting a Taste Traditions of Wisconsin event this Thursday at the Historical Society Museum in Madison. The registration for the event is closed, but you can find out more about those events, dinner and lecture series that explore Wisconsin history, by going to wisconsinhistory.org. You can also find information on a biography that was written for young readers about Joyce Hill Westerman. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, very happy to be sitting in for Kathleen Dunn today. Kathleen will be back tomorrow. Special thanks to KP Whaley, who produced both hours today. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Thanks for listening.